Hey everyone, welcome to the Woj Pod. Today, my extended SportsCenter interview with Los Angeles Clippers owner Steve Ballmer. We talk about the exit of Chris Paul, the lessons learned for his organization in the aftermath of the trade to Houston, the future with Blake Griffin, DeAndre Jordan, the challenge of competing against the Lakers in the Southern California market, and what he's learned in his time as an NBA owner here in LA. Now here's my conversation with Steve Ballmer. Steve, you've had a few weeks to reflect on the trade that the Clippers made with Houston, with Chris Paul. In the time since, how much reflection have you done about whether the organization did enough, whether it was environmentally with Chris Paul, whether you had the right assets to be able to keep him? How much thought have you put into all that about where you may have fallen short with him?
I've put in, and asked the organization, put in enormous energy on that topic. All of my experiences, the most important thing in any good company, organization, team in this case, is to have great talent. And when somebody chooses to leave, you have to ask yourself, what could we have done better? Now, there are situational things. You know, we've been together a long time and haven't had the success in the playoffs that all of us, including Chris, might have wanted. So Chris has his own set of goals and desires, but it's still our job to get the best talent in the world to play for the LA Clippers. And so we're still in the process of really saying, what do we do better? I like the team we have together for next year. I think we've done a great job on that. And yet with that said, we're asking, what do we need to improve in the support we give our players? What do we need to improve in our team environment? What do we need to improve in our roster management? What do we need to improve in terms of our flexibility to make sure that we can surround the best players with the best additional talent on the team? So we're sort of going through it all now, and we'll take corrective actions.
You had a presentation prepared for him about the future and how you guys viewed building around him and Blake Griffin, DeAndre Jordan. You never got to present that after July 1, the trade happened with Chris opting into his contract. Was there some regret there that you never got to the plate with him the way you hoped you would?
Well, I think the big learning for me is the presentation, at least to your own guys, is kind of the final piece. It's not the first piece in the discussion. You know, I'd been talking to Chris about coming back, as is everybody else, but he and I had talked about it as early as April before playoffs started. We'd been in regular communication before July 1st. You can't get into some things under the CBA, but we had been talking about the team and where we're going and the like. And I wish we'd gotten to the presentation, but I think that it wasn't the presentation that was the issue. It was the issues that we were working that nonetheless weren't addressing some of the things on Chris's minds. And I think Chris, like the rest of us, knew something had to be different this year. We all wanted something to be different, and Chris decided that the best different for him was to go to Houston.
As an owner, what have you learned about relationships with star players? You've built relationships with Chris Paul, with Blake Griffin. You went through the process with DeAndre Jordan. In 3+ years, what have you learned about your role in those relationships and how it impacts a team going forward?
Well, general manager puts the roster together. The coach coaches the players. But what's the owner? The owner is the one guy everybody knows is going to be there for the long haul. So whether you're a star player, whether you're a coach, whether you're the GM, the owner is the person who's the point of consistency. And so you need to have a relationship. People, you're the anchor, the rock, so to speak. Everybody else is going to do, let me call it, the real work. On the other hand, when it looks to commitments to be the same, to change, to invest in luxury tax, that commitment's got to come from the one person who you can count on to be around. So I think it's very important for me as an owner to have a relationship with all of our, let me call it, top talent. That obviously includes the top players and others. It includes the coaches and the assistant coaches. It includes, in our case, Lawrence Frank, who runs our front office, and key members of his staff. It's like, in this sense, it's like in any other business. You have to not only know the guys who are, quote, working directly for you, but you got to know their top people and what they're thinking, what they're feeling. And in my third year as an owner, I feel like I have a much better handle on how to go do that. And there's an importance to do it because the owner's the person who's always around.
Because relationships within your group have been under a lot of scrutiny internally, you've spent a lot of time with it externally, relationships among your star players, relationships with coach management, have you had to become more involved in managing the time that's been put into that, how everybody has, you know, tried to interact and build out long-term? Because it's been at times a point of I think, crisis for the group and getting everybody on the same page.
Well, what I would say is a little different. You can never manage around people. You've got to, you know, you have to bet on the people who you put in place. And one of the key things you have to figure out is, do you have the right configuration? Do we have the right, do we need to change people around at all? Did we, you know, would we at the end of the season? We wanted Chris back. We got Blake back, thank goodness. But, you know, how would we think about that? Owners got to have a point of view about that. And yet, day-to-day dealing with, you know, whatever the, let's call it, personal interactions or relationships with, that can't be the owner's job either. You know, I live in Seattle. I'm down here a lot, but I'm not there, you know, every day. That's where, you know, Doc Rivers is and Lawrence Frank is and the top players. But I have to know what's going on.
Were you apprehensive at all when you look at your payroll going forward that if you gave Chris that five-year max deal, that when he was 36, 37 years old, where most point guards have fallen off a bit by then, that you had been paying him $46, $47 million. Was that a point of concern for the organization when you were trying to make a decision about how you built your team out?
Yeah. Well, you were sort of charitable. You said most point guards have fallen off a little bit. If you look at the statistics, most point guards fall off the cliff after about 35-ish. So was it a concern? Of course it was a concern. Now, we were fully committed to do that with Chris because we think Chris is an exceptional player, as is Blake and DJ. We've had three exceptional players. And for a chance to win a championship, we take the risk knowing it could be a real difficulty in those out years. But did we have to stop and say, whoops, you know, what's coming here? Yeah, we thought about it.
By Houston coming to you with the idea of a trade and Chris opting in, you had a decision to make about whether you wanted to let Chris go into free agency and see if Houston could find a way to create the space for him or get assets back and do the trade before July 1. How difficult of a process was that to say, essentially, we're going to give up on this and get something for him, not lose him for nothing?
Well, essentially, what you're doing is assessing your gut probability on whether he's going to go anyway and whether Houston's really going to put the package together for him anyway. And, you know, I think it was likely Houston was going to go ahead and Chris was going to go ahead and free agency, although it would have had significantly additional major impact on their roster. So, yeah, you could get into some funny game of chicken, but to us it made more sense to say, okay, let's accept that this is kind of where we are, what Chris wants to go do. It's going to happen probably one way or the other. And, you know, if you say, what did we get out of that trade, it's really quite remarkable. You know, Montrezl Harrell, unbelievably, you know, good player to have coming off the bench for us. Lou Williams is outstanding. Sam Decker, we think, has all the potential in the world. Pat Beverly, man, that guy's got a certain kind of energy
that I
really like. And Danilo Gallinari. Gallo really came out of that trade, unless it's not clear. He's part of what we got for Chris, because the first round pick that it took to get Gallo came in that trade with Houston. So if you take a look and say, we got those five players in return for a guy who was probably going to leave anyway, touchdown is what I say. That's pretty good.
Had you spent time looking to it, Oklahoma City losing Kevin Durant, you saw after you Gordon Hayward leaving Utah, they got nothing for those players. That is, an owner, you said, we've got to accept maybe defeat here and keep our eye on the longer view here, that we don't want to just lose him for nothing.
Well, of course, you never want to lose a player that's great for nothing. And so you make judgments as to, you know, whether the person's going to walk or stay. And, you know, I feel for Oklahoma City and Utah. They made judgments and then they got nothing. We made judgments and then we had a little bit of smart judgment and a little bit of luck that it helped Houston a lot to do this trade as opposed to just do a free agent signing. And when that opportunity presented itself, it was clear to Lawrence, to Doc, to me that we should jump on it. And you know, Houston was interested in engaging. Chris handled it all the right way in terms of, you know, us doing this deal with Houston. And I wound up thinking it was a great thing for our team.
You pivoted. You signed Blake Griffin to 5-year, you know, long-term deal. Does he become again the face of your franchise?
Well, somebody asked Blake the other day about being the face of the franchise, and I loved his answer. He said, "We don't sit around the locker room talking about who's the face of the franchise." You know, we have been very fortunate to have 3 All-Star caliber players on our team. Chris has moved on. We still have 2 All-Star caliber players, and we've picked up some guys who are like Gallo, who I would say not All-Star, but right close there. And so I think, you know, Blake and DJ, as the senior people on the team, assume a mantle of leadership. Blake's, you know, kind of a, they're both larger than life characters, but because Blake handles the ball and some of that, he's clearly going to be a centerpiece, particularly for us offensively. But the face of the franchise, heck, I hope we have a lot of faces that our fans can fall in love with.
Doc Rivers in the dual role as president and coach, that was the structure you had when you took over. You signed him to a contract extension after you bought the team. But you've changed the management structure of your team. Lawrence Frank runs largely the day-to-day operations of the front office now. What was your examination around Doc as you looked at trying to do both jobs and the best way to have a structure there that allowed him to maybe to succeed as a coach and have maybe more process in place in your front office than you had?
Well, I think there's really 2 clearly and separate jobs. You can ask how much it can sort of present a challenge to do either one well by trying to think about the other one. But they are 2 really clear and separate jobs, maybe in a way I also didn't anticipate when I took over the team. Right after I bought the team, actually, Pete Carroll is a neighbor of mine. And he said, "Come on in, John Schneider and I'll tell you how to run a football team, how to run a sports team." And it was great. I sat down with the 2 of them. They explained kind of their relationship, which is its own work of art between coach and general manager and, you know, how decisions get made. But they respect the fact they have 2 very completely different jobs, and they want each other and they need each other. And I'm learning from that, and I'm learning as we go in our own situation.
What did you misjudge about maybe the enormity of the front office part of it and the day-to-day process of building out long-term? Did you misjudge maybe the importance of every move and how it relates to the bigger picture?
Well, I think in my first few years in the job, we were almost right there. We were just about there. All we had to do was do this, and we'd be over the hump. And everything seemed secondary to being just over the hump. And then you're not building the foundation. And I don't think we have the strength we needed. I think with Lawrence moving to the front office, we have really grown our capability there quite a bit. But then you take a look back, and you go through a bunch of the decisions that we've made, and say, wow. You know, sometimes you could say, well, of course, knowing what I know now, I'd make that differently. But it reflects a pattern of things that we did for what turned out to be probably a little bit more shorter term, more, come on, we're almost there, guys, as opposed to thinking things through completely for the mid and long term in addition to the short term. And, you know, with our mid-level exceptions, with our draft picks, you know, could we have done better with some of our trades? Yeah, we almost certainly could.
You feel now that the decisions you're making are with the longer view in mind, like you said, whether it was you look back at your record of draft picks, and you didn't have great picks. You were picking in the 20s, but you want to hit on some. And I think the other thing you've talked a lot about internally, giving away picks in deals, that I think picks have more value than they've ever had in the league. Is there a greater premium in your organization now on draft picks?
Yeah, absolutely there is. I'm not going to say there wasn't a premium, but the price went up, you know, if you will, the value of those picks. It is interesting. I've had the stats guy go through, you know, sort of who plays in the league. You go by pick you were picked with, what you wound up being. Did you wind up being a franchise player, da-da-da-da-da-da? And, you know, it is true. Most of the guys who are in the league would be in the top 20. Once you get past about the 35th pick, you aren't going to find too many people who've made a major difference. But then you get guys like Isaiah Thomas and Manu Ginobili. And you say, look, we need to value these things both as currency, as part of trades, but also then we have to be really good at scouting and getting the talent with those picks. And I think appreciating that whole process, that has certainly risen. You know, Doc came in without experience in the front office side and with a team that was pretty darn good. And the impetus really was to make every move. And the former owner had different views of how to do things. I can't speak because I think some of the things that happened before I got here and with Doc here may have come from a whole different philosophy of how to run a franchise. But we've learned a lot.
The Woj Pod.
Steve, we'll continue in a moment, but I need to ask my listeners, do you know what is the secret of a well-groomed guy? Well, it's the Art of Shaving. Founded in New York in 1996, the Art of Shaving has been helping guys look their best for over 20 years. The Art of Shaving has your total routine covered, whether shaving, beard, maintenance, hair, skin, body, or fragrance. The Art of Shaving's award-winning products are formulated with the highest quality botanical ingredients featuring pure essential oils. The four elements of the perfect shave have been created to deliver smooth results every day. Start by prepping skin with their signature pre-shave oil, then create a thick foamy lather with shaving cream applied with a shave brush. Shave, then replenish moisture with their aftershave balm. Finish off the perfect shave with one of five fragrances. Each cologne has been carefully assembled for a distinctive scent. The Art of Shaving offers a convenient replenishment service that allows you to save on your favorite products while never having to worry. And now, here's a great deal for you. Our listeners will receive 15% off their first order and free shipping by using the promo code WOJ. To get this offer, go online to theartofshaving.com, use my special promo code WOJ to get 15% off your first order and free shipping. Visit theartofshaving.com for the special offer, or for a consultation with a grooming expert, step into one of their many retail locations near you. And now back to my conversation with Clippers owner Steve Ballmer. What was the, when you look back now at the residue of buying a team, inheriting a culture that was Donald Sterling's culture here for a long time, was it harder than you imagined to sort of undo a lot of what went on here for 25, 30 years in your relatively short time now?
Well, I'd say the answer to that is yes and no. The culture is different than I think people thought it would be. In a sense, the culture didn't reflect the owner. The culture reflect protecting itself from you know, sort of volatility. The culture was a very conservative culture, ironically. And, you know, that, particularly on the business side, I think that changes when you start, you know, turning over people. If you look at the senior leadership team on our business side, I think there's only one person, maybe two, left from the old guard. On the basketball side, which of course is where everybody wants to see what's going on, I don't think it's fair to say Doc was Sterling culture. Doc, you know, was able to sort of largely isolate. The front office is probably the area that still had most cultural resemblance to the Sterling era, and that really changed when we put Lawrence Frank in charge last year.
I think there might have been a perception when you took over the team that you were going to be heavily involved in basketball operations, decisions. I think it was just the opposite, but how have you learned to find ways to get your voice in there, to get become part of the process where you can impact the basketball decisions? Have you kind of found your way in that area?
Yeah, I think I really have. When I came in first year or so, you know, my goal was to learn, not to sit there and be okay. I know everything. I want to, you know, trade baseball cards or like you used to do when you're, at least at my age when you're a kid. Mm-hmm. And so it was important that I really not go there for the first year or two. What I have learned is there's a very important role for me to be activist on the basketball side. Again, not micromanaging, but there are a lot of good questions that can be asked. Do we really have all the talent that we need to assess prospects? Are we really being smart in our use in the cap? Cap management, there's a math camp side of that, and I love math. So let's go through, let's run through all the scenarios. How do we get cap space here? What about here? What about here? Where do we get additional picks? How do we do this? Boom, 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 boom. I feel very equipped to participate in a good part of this. Now, if the guys come to me and say, look, we have a choice between this guy and this guy for our last minimum slot, I'm not going to have a lot of opinions about that. I'll push, have you thought about other people? What's your thought process? But I'm not going to try to say, well, this player is better than that player. I'm not equipped. That's not my expertise. But thinking strategically, you mentioned earlier mid and long term. The truth is you got to think short, mid, and long. Doc reminds me, you don't get too many chances to win a championship, so you kind of have to muscle up when you do have the chance. But you got to still remain thoughtful about the medium and long term.
Your role models in sports ownership when you bought the team, who you said, I'd like to emulate what they're doing, how that owner does it. Are they the same now as they were then? Has that thought evolved as you've owned a team?
I never really thought about it that way. Role models. I would say my role models weren't owners. My role models were team success. You say, gosh, I wish I could be like the Patriots. It's easy to say I want to be like the Spurs or the old-time Lakers but the Patriots, that was sort of one that really lodged with me and say, how do you be like that? But I never thought about it from the owner's perspective. I said, what do I want our team to look like? Learning to be an owner, I've had a little coaching. Paul Allen and I worked together at Microsoft and have been friends for gobs of years. And he'd tell me what he does with the Seahawks, who won a Super Bowl, good things to model there, and with the Trailblazers. But you go around, you meet owners at the various NBA meetings, and there are guys certainly who do things really well. Mickey Arison caught my attention early on. He obviously have a great franchise in Miami. But you can see how it comes from leadership and direction.
Since you brought on Jerry West in an advisory role, how much of your conversations have been built around ownership role and team success? He worked, obviously, Jerry Buss had tremendous impact not only in L.A., but all around the league. Has West influenced your thinking on how you want to do things?
Absolutely. It's been great to get Jerry on board. First of all, let me say, I just hope I have that level of kind of energy and tenacity when I'm 79. But he's got all these ideas, things to think about, experiences to share. Not just looking back, but it's always sort of very applied to the present. There get to be times where you could say, oh, you want to just look back and say, well, I remember when we did this, or I remember when we did that. Well, Jerry will do a little bit of that, but not much. Mostly he's saying, hey, I've learned this. This is how an owner should think about their role here. Hey, here's a principle that we can use here that's been important to me, but we should use it in this way, as we, face this roster decision. And it's been great to have him to talk to. And in a sense, I really think with Lawrence, with Jerry, with Doc, with me, we have a senior team on the basketball side that can really talk things through, and I think we're going to just get better and better.
How much the impact of hiring Jerry West in Los Angeles, an iconic Laker figure, and largely still a Laker town, there's years to overcome of Laker fandom here, and how much of a part of hiring Jerry was having the Clippers have a Laker icon front and center?
Not at all. I mean, it would kind of be a cool PR stunt for 5 minutes if that's what it was about. I don't have the time, I don't have the money, I don't have the patience for cool PR stunts. Jerry gets it. The guy really, he's done it. He has been involved in putting together the most successful rosters in the NBA. And that's why we're working with Jerry. And that's what I appreciate about Jerry. Yes, is there a little bit of a kind of a nice little cute irony or something around the side? Sure. But, Jerry's a talent, and I enjoy working with Jerry, and Jerry already has been, in whatever, a month, a tremendous asset to the Los Angeles Clippers.
The Clippers are competing against 29 other teams in the NBA, but in Los Angeles, competing against the Lakers, playing in the same arena as them, not getting necessarily the home dates you want in the arena as maybe the third tenant after a basketball and a hockey team, how much of your struggle day-to-day is not just the whole league, but competing in Los Angeles with that franchise?
We got 20 other, nine. I mean, really, we have to be 29 other teams. And I keep that front and foremost in my mind. When I walk around and people say, oh, go Lakers, does that bother? Of course it bugs me. You know, I'm not used to that. I've never been in a city where you actually had two hometown teams. You know, Seattle, when we had a bad, we have a football team. You can like what the Seahawks are doing or not like it, but you don't start rooting for somebody else. It just doesn't happen. So, yeah, it's an unusual thing for me, but we have 29 other teams we need to beat. Now, do our fans, and I've kind of got into the gestalt of this, get a little extra je ne sais quoi when we beat the Lakers? Yeah, they do. I got to say, yes, and I do too at this stage. But, you know, if we beat the Lakers four times, let's say, in a season, and we finish under 500, don't make the playoffs, and don't go anywhere, that is not a good season. It's about beating 29 other teams, and we know that. I also know there's only one way, really, to have this become as much a Clipper town as Laker town. One way and one way only. And that's to do what we want to do anyway, which is to win an NBA championship.
Beyond the economics of having your own arena, you've started down the path of exploring the possibility of building an arena out in Englewood. From an identity standpoint, to not be in the Lakers arena in Staples, how important is that for the Clippers?
I think it's certainly valuable to have a place that is, I'll say, our own, if you will. You know, Staples is sort of an icon, and of course, we're the third tenant. There's just no question. And being the third tenant has lots of downsides. Identity is one of them, but I think there are just other things also we can do for our fans. Staples has been built with great majesty to have many, you know, large groups in it. It's a little different than the field, housey field that you get in some of the other arenas. I think Clipper fans are, can't speak to Laker fans. Our fans are hardcore basketball fans, and we want to give them that kind of, you know, intense basketball experience that they want. And that may be easier to do in a different kind of environment. So we think our fans may want something different. Yeah, we'd like to play on the best nights. There's some sort of modern ways that people are appointing buildings these days. You see it in what they did in Madison Square Garden, what they're doing in Golden State. So, yeah, we're looking at it very seriously, and we're seeing what we can put together in Inglewood.
Steve, you spent $2 billion to buy the Clippers at a time where the number, I think the sticker shock of that number was, I think, reverberated around the league. I don't think it seems as big of a number now as it did then. Are you curious to see the impact of that purchase and what you paid for now as the Houston Rockets go on sale, to see what other teams are going to go for? Did you set a bar with buying this team and how it's going to impact the rest of any other teams now that are going to be up for sale?
Yeah, I'm interested. I mean, look, I think it's probably fair to say the market for basketball teams is an illiquid market. It's not like stocks that trade every day, and so you can see, okay, well, you know, Microsoft's at 73.27 today. Oops, it's 29, right? 73.29. Basketball teams, you know, what maybe one sells every 3 years, something like that, order of magnitude, or maybe two every 3 years, and you say, okay, what are the prices going to be? And there, the market price is set by the transactions. Could I have gotten the Clippers cheaper, maybe 5% cheaper? We know what the market is. What we don't know is what the market is, how the market is that much different between here and other cities. LA is a special city. It's not only a place that has its own affluence, it is a place that affluent people from around the world want to come and live and invest, which might not be true in every city in the U.S. Houston will be an interesting case. How many of the people who show up to buy it will be from the U.S., from outside the U.S., the stock market continues to be high stock market, good for NBA valuations because people usually pay in some form of derivative of stock. Houston's the center of the oil industry. You get people coming from Russia, from Latin America, from the Mideast. They all come to Houston on business anyway. It has a bit of an LA flavor in that regard. I'll be curious to see what it sells for, but it, in a way, it's a more global city than most of the franchises. Yao Ming's played there. I certainly wish Les Alexander well, and we'll see what it sells for. We looked at Atlanta. I think something over $1 billion. Mm-hmm. I think if you had said that before I bought the Clips, people would have thought that was nuts. but it's what the market will bear in today's stock market valuations.
Before you bought the Clippers, you had spent a lot of time in Seattle trying to get, you know, the arena initiative to bring a team to Seattle. Obviously, your team is here now. Is there a part of you that is still hopeful that for that city, for that region that lost the Sonics, that an NBA team finds its way back there?
Yeah, I'd love Seattle to have an NBA team. It won't be mine, but I live in a great city. It's a first-class city. It's one of the more affluent cities in the United States. It wants, it can support, it deserves an NBA city. Now, the way things worked, and I'll take some accountability. I had a full-time job. If I hadn't had a full-time job, I probably would have just bought the Sonics before they sold to the guys in Oklahoma City. I didn't. I had a job. Well, okay, then we tried to, you know, sort of fix it along the line. Oh, let's try to get the arena built. Oh, let's try to move Sacramento. But in a sense, what it tells you is when you lose a team, when you start that process, it's really hard to come back. And I want the city to get a team. It'll depend on, you know, someday, you know, will there be expansion or not? There's been no discussion of that since I've been an owner. It'll depend on other teams and their leases and who wants to sell them. But I got my fingers crossed that the Clippers will be able to come up to Seattle and win some ball games.
Did you regret for a long time not buying the team when you had the opportunity?
I didn't regret during the process. I didn't. When we didn't get Sacramento, I was disappointed. I said, wow, it's possible there won't be a team back here. I just sort of assumed, of course, there'll be a team back here. I was still working at Microsoft when the Sacramento thing went down. And I said, God, you mean there really might not be a team back here soon? And that was kind of like a, ooh, mind blower. And then I retired, and I went to see Adam Silver and said, yeah, I really do want to buy a team. How do we get one to Seattle? He said, there's no magic formula for that. And then he said, but you might want to look at some of these other teams that come up for sale. And I said, okay, that's got to be my path. I was, I don't know, whatever it was, 58, 59 at the time. And it's not like I want to wait 10 years to have a franchise. It's now. Now's the time to be having some fun. So I was just lucky as heck that the Clippers came up for sale. I love Los Angeles. It's a weather's a little nicer down here than Seattle in the wintertime. You know, I could look back and say, sure, if I'd bought the Sonics, we'd have a nice arena in Seattle. We'd have James Harden, Kevin Durant, Russell Westbrook, all playing on a team in Seattle. But, you know, that's not the way things are. And you know what? I'm happy with where I am.
Steve, thanks for doing this. I appreciate it.
Thanks, Woj.
All right. Thanks for listening to this episode of the Woj Pod. A big thank you to my guest today, Clippers owner Steve Ballmer. Remember, you can subscribe and listen to new and archived episodes of the Woj Pod wherever you get your podcasts. You can find us on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Stitcher, TuneIn, Spotify, or wherever you get your shows. You can also hear the Woj Pod every Wednesday and Friday at 3 p.m. Eastern on Sirius XM Satellite Radio, on Sirius Channel 214, XM Channel 203, and on the Sirius XM app on Channel 967. I'd also like to take a moment to thank our sponsor today, The Art of Shaving. Be sure to support them the way they support us here at the Woj Pod. We'll catch you next time.